The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Coming up, apathy in the UK. Only 18% turnout in the Manchester Central by-election, and there's lower still for the much-mocked police commissioner elections. A freak result, or is Britain just giving up on the ballot box? Labour takes Corby from the Tories as the government's majority in Parliament is eroded. And there are big swings away from the Lib Dems, and it seems towards UKIP candidates. Also this week, he's out again. Terrorism suspect Abu Qatada wins the right to remain in Britain at the Court of Appeal. Plus, we are the 0.0001%. China's new leader is selected by just 2,000 delegates at the 18th Communist Party Congress. Our Beijing correspondent, Tanya Branigan, tells us all that's known, and it's not all that much, about Xi Jinping. But joining me in the studio now, political columnists Martin Kettle and Anne Perkins, and our Home Affairs editor, Alan Travis. Warm welcome to you all. So, Alan, first of all, you've, insofar as anyone's taken a keen interest in these police commissioner elections, I guess you have. The news on the day seems to be low levels of turnout. Just how bad is it?
Dismal, I think. The Electoral Reform Society says the lowest in British political history. Seems like about an average of 15%. We've had turnout figures for about 35 of the 41 contests. And I think that raises serious questions of legitimacy over the future of these police commission elections. The polling day anecdotes about polling stations being left completely idle for hours on end. They've established there was one polling station in Newport in Gwent where no votes were cast at all during the entire opening hours of polling. We had a chap, the returning officer in Leeds polling station, who told us after about 6 o'clock at night he'd had only 71 voters out of the 1,100 on his roll. But the bright news was that Spider-Man had voted.
They all count. OK, so Anne Perkins, dismal turnout, widely projected, but it's on the dismal side of the dismal projections. Who do you blame? Is it the weather? Is it the kind of political fudge that ended up with this thing being delayed to a time when there's no other elections on? Or is it that people just don't want to vote for people to be in charge of policing?
Well, I mean, where do you begin? And I tell you, when you're looking at the turnout figures, you ought also to consider the extraordinarily high level of spoilt ballots, which are, and they're included in the turnout count, but they're running at around 3+%, which means that the people who actually took part in electing a candidate is going to be even lower than we already know that it is. But, you know, if you try to find out who your candidates were, if you live out of London, and if you have internet access, and if you are interested enough, you go and look online, and there is still very little intelligible information about the candidates, and really not readily enough available that there's no context of, you know, kind of how they think they're going to do the job. So I think, even the people who did vote voted in an absolute cloud of ignorance, despite their best efforts. Listening to the phone-ins on the radio and so on this morning, a lot of people really felt they just didn't know enough to vote. I think, you know, good citizens really just thought, I don't understand what I'm being asked to do. And then on top of that, of course, we get kind of negligible political input from political leaders. As I think Adam pointed out the other day, no one mentioned these elections in their speeches at party conferences only last month. Very little high-profile engagement by party political leaders. And I think, you know, the results all around.
Martin, one thing earlier on in this, well, two things in this process narrowly that maybe went wrong, aren't there? One was the Lib Dems didn't really want these elections at all and managed to shunt them off to November. And the other one is that number 10, for a bit of easy penny pinching, said, oh, let's not, or to make a stand about how it was pinching the penny, said, we're not going to let people send out messages about their candidacy.
Yes, well, I mean, I think the lack of information and the lack, you know, the lack of engagement was immense, if something negative can be immense. And people didn't, on the whole, as Anne said, they didn't get information put through their letterboxes. And in British elections, that is still shown to be the way that people inform themselves most. I don't live in London, so I had a vote in these elections. And I think we got one thing put through the letterbox. That was from Labour, but nothing from any of the other parties. And I think the... You know, also, you've got the problem that The campaign has been very much involving political parties. Political parties are not best flavour of the month at the moment. People don't quite see the point in these elections. And they're also not running against the record of an incumbent. So, you know, it's quite hard to kind of kickstart the interest in it when people don't quite see what they're voting for, I think.
Perhaps offer a slightly alternative explanation. At least one former chief constable said to me, at least Spider-Man was on the web, and I think Martin's right about the lack of information for those people. 7 million voters didn't have internet access, about the lack of a postal free shot. But perhaps there's another alternative explanation, which is this isn't apathy, but this is actually people quite happy. There's a study came out on Thursday from Professor Paul Wiles at University of Essex National Policy Centre, suggesting that actually satisfaction levels with the police have been rising rapidly in the last few years, and with falling crime, that finally maybe it's been pay off, that people don't feel that much anger about the way the police operate, although we know of plenty high profile examples. So, for example, if you had if there was an NHS election, local for an NHS local health board commissioner, and they were proposing to close the local ANA unit, you may get a very large turnout. It may be that people are actually not apathetic, they just don't seem to feel the need to go and vote in anger against the way the police are being run.
I mean, just one thing about the spoilt ballot papers. I mean, I think probably most people didn't know anything about the contest, really, but B, they didn't really know about the electoral system in which they had a supplementary vote, same system as they have in the London mayoral election. And I suspect a proportion of the spoilt ballot papers will have been people who weren't quite sure what they were doing with the system. So, I mean, but that's part of the fact that, you know, yeah, but people weren't really taking it that seriously.
I think that's probably true. But I mean, I think there's an element of people what I like to call abstaining in person, shall we say, want to turn up at the polling station and say we don't want to take part in this election as a protest rather than because of apathy. Labour have set themselves a yardstick of winning a majority of policing, i.e. they want to win a majority of the police forces in terms of budgets and officers, which basically means winning 11 to 12 of the 41 major metropolitan forces. There was a moment about 2:30 on Friday afternoon when they looked as though they might lose the West Midlands, but they won that one. That's the biggest force which has had an election on this week. So they're okay there. They lost North Wales to an independent, and they maybe had hopes of winning Dyfed Powys, which also they lost to the Tories. I think the question of the fate of John Prescott will become symbolic in terms of how well Labour did in these elections.
And let's just turn for a minute to the by-elections. Again, it looks like Labour has won Corby, and it's certainly won in Manchester Central and in Cardiff South and Penarth, with very big swing in Manchester Central and a smaller one in Cardiff. But nothing out of the ordinary, you think, for midterm?
Well, probably not. I mean, I'm wondering if perhaps really the kind of biggest and most difficult result is going to be for the Lib Dems and especially their relationship with UKIP. And we know, as we record, that there's a recount going on to find out if the Lib Dems have lost their deposit. It looks as if they may have scored marginally fewer votes than UKIP, and that will be extremely worrying news for them, although perhaps not necessarily unexpected, and also a very bad omen for the Euro elections. Just fleetingly returning to the PCC elections, I think it is interesting. Two points I'd like to make. One, I think Labour's actually won with two very strong women candidates, particularly Vera Baird and also Jane Kennedy. And also, I think it's interesting that the independents have done well in the PCC elections. They've won three of the against the five each for the others. And I think there might be some interesting candidates, although against that, I think at least one of them is two of them, I think, are former coppers. And that makes one worry for this more abrasive relationship, which the police minister was trailing a few days ago.
So, Martin, just pick up on the Lib Dems and mentions, maybe that's one of the clearest signs, is that, you know, again, they've done quite badly. The BBC was reporting earlier that they'd been beaten by the spoilt ballot paper party in Coventry. It's interesting, isn't it? Because if it's UKIP and then some of these independent candidates, some former police officers, that they might represent strands that are very different from the centrism of the Liberal Democrats, and yet they're still picking up the kind of malcontent vote, which is quite a big chunk of the electorate.
In other circumstances, if there were not a coalition government with the Lib Dems in it, you might expect the Lib Dems to do really quite well in some of these elections if the balance of political forces in government was different. But, I mean, it's catastrophic for them. It's at least as bad as any other election result that they've had since they went into coalition. I think that they're showing in the police elections and in the by-elections, I mean, there's not a glimmer of satisfaction that they can take from this. And so, you know, and I think it's another very serious blow for them.
They're doing quite well in South Somerset.
Well, this is...
told me.
This is, of course, those of us who watch South Somerset acutely would know that that was going to happen. But, I mean, just on the UKIP thing... I think going forward, that is one of the interesting facts to hang on to from these elections, that UKIP actually doesn't have that kind of devastating potential in these kind of elections against the Tories that some Tories pretend or would like to pretend that they do have. I mean, that's not to say that UKIP won't do very well in the European elections in a couple of years' time. I think they probably will. But I think it's very easy and convenient to exaggerate the UKIP factor.
You mentioned Alan Powers earlier, where the Tories have just snuck through in Wales, Defyd Powers. And if it turns out that the Conservatives have done a bit better than an unpopular governing party would be expected to in midterms, do you think that might be because when it comes to law and order, and this is a law and order ballot, they normally do a bit better than on other subjects?
Well, this is their single most strongest issue in opinion polling. You expect the Tories to do well in a law and order election. That's one reason why they had the law and order, had them on the law and order a ticket. But I don't see any great sign of them making huge progress. I think the overwhelming fact of this election is the very low turnout, the fact that 85% of people eligible to vote have not voted. And that's where the result of the election lies. When you get this low level of turnout, 15%, you will get independents, you will get others coming through, you'll get perverse results, which you can't read into any kind of message in a national level. A victory for the Conservatives in, say, West Mercia with its 500,000 people cannot be equated with a win for Labour in Greater Manchester, which has 2.5 million people. It means nothing on a national stage, and I think that the only lesson we can take from in terms of the performance of either Tory or Labour is whether in their own benchmarks in terms of which police forces they hope to control, whether they have done so or not. I think the independents have come through strongly, and it's interesting the last election in which such a low turnout with previous benchmark 23-24% in the 1999 Euros was the election when UKIP emerged on the national stage. And it's interesting, UKIP so far haven't really made much impact here.
But maybe it's the independents who are picking up that kind of constituency. And never mind the numbers, which is Alan saying there's lots of reasons we've got to be careful with, and some of them are still being crunched. How big a moment is it for Ed Miliband now that he has taken a by-election in the swinging south of the country from the Conservatives, numbers aside, just winning that vote in Corby?
Yeah, I mean, of course it's of course that's good for him. And the awful thing is it's kind of good. It seems to me that it's good in a negative way. It would have been catastrophic if he hadn't, or if he'd only done it narrowly, because of the circumstances in which the by-election was called. It doesn't feel to me, I'm open to correction on this, as if this is a particular confirmatory seal of approval by the voters for Ed Miliband. I think it would have to have been a much more triumphant victory than it looks as if it's going to be that. And just because of the nature of the by-election, I'm just a little bit cautious about it.
Right. Martin, we've just got the result for Corby, and Andy Sawford, the Labour candidate, has won by 7,791 votes, so a majority of almost 8,000. Where does that put it in the pantheon of by-election wins?
Terrific win for Labour. Turnout not great, 45%, but obviously better than the police elections at the same day. I mean, the important thing for Labour is that it's won a Tory seat. It doesn't often do that. It hasn't done that since before Blair was elected as Prime Minister, just before then in 1996-7. So, you know, this is definitely a signal that Labour is on its way to contesting the next election as a possible winner. And, you know, to have around 50% of the vote in a seat, which in 2010 they got 39%, yeah, that's a really solid result. And it's, good news for Ed Miliband. I'm sure he'll be up in Corby this afternoon celebrating it, because he's every grounds for doing so. I think the other thing, just to add rather quickly, is that, you know, this whole day of elections, of the police crime commissioners has been pretty humiliating for the Tory party. It's not going to be something that they are going to be able to say, you know, look, the new Tory party has achieved something major and democratic and effective and that the people wanted and have endorsed, because that just manifestly hasn't happened. It's been a humiliation.
Okay, so let's just talk about another awkwardness for the Conservatives this week, because there was another setback for the government with the release of terrorism suspect Abu Qatada. You've been covering it, Alan. How much of a problem is this for the Home Secretary, and how, what's the significance of the latest twist in what's been a very long-running tale?
Well, in April, the Home Secretary was probably within a couple of weeks of being able to deport Abu Qatada back to Jordan. She's now in a situation following a ruling by the Special Immigration Appeals Commission that having gone all the way to Jordan, negotiated guarantees about his sort of trial he will face in the National State Security Court in Jordan. A London court has now come back and said those guarantees are not good enough, and they think that he would still face a real risk of being tried on torture-based evidence. That in itself is a victory for human rights, but it comes at a price in that it will now intensify even further the struggle and battle between the judges and the politicians over the future of human rights legislation framework in this country. I think that Theresa May will try and overturn this at the Court of Appeal, but this is a legal battle that could take months, if not further years. And we've heard Chris Grayling this week renew his intention to rewrite the Tory party manifesto for the next election on the question of repealing the Human Rights Act and the country's commitment to the European Convention of Human Rights. And I think this will the effect of this particular judgment will carry on and echo down all the way to the general election.
And the fact that this was a ruling by a British court, you know, this Special Immigration Appeals Commission, that doesn't make it any less of a issue in terms of human rights.
No, these are British human rights as well as European human rights. They are human rights which are generalised. They mean, apply to all humans, Brits and all Europeans. And I think it's highly likely the Court of Appeal will uphold that ruling, as possibly the Supreme Court will as well. So it's going to be a long battle.
And Martin, there's very few people who want Abu Qatada to stay in Britain, and yet he has to.
Well, you know, we live under the rule of law. The rule of law gives the courts the authority in these matters to rule what the law says. That's what they have done. The European Court has done that too. The courts are often extremely deferential to governments on matters of national security, but they do, on the whole, rightly, as people would want them to do, draw the line very clearly against the danger of torture and what torture can do to defile the criminal justice process. And, you know, although people can huff and puff about the Abu Qatada, and nobody around this table or anywhere else much has any time for Abu Qatada, I mean, the fact is he is a human being entitled to human rights. And those rights include not to be tried on the basis of evidence obtained under torture. And as long as that can't be guaranteed that the evidence is safe, you know, it's right that he stays here. It's very unpleasant for us, and it's costly, and all the other stuff that people complain about is true. But, you know, there are principles at stake here, and we don't want a government that ignores the law.
And Anne, as long as Theresa May doesn't take the extra step that the most stringent Tories want and just put him on the plane, do you think it's politically neutralised because everyone's sort of saying he should be sent back, but no one thinks it can actually be done?
I think from that narrow point of view, it probably is. But as Alan was pointing out, it's Theresa May is a pretty kind of, you know, she's played a very dead bat in that job and has consequently done kind of relatively well. But it is embarrassing for her. She did say he was, you know, on the brink of being sent away, although she's as distant from these PCC elections as it's possible to be when they're in your own department. Nonetheless, they, you know, some of the mudslinging that's going to already started, actually, from the Conservative Party about them is going to stick to her. So not a happy week for Mrs May.
Well, let's leave that there for now. You can find more on the Qatada story and a full list of the developing election results at guardian.co.uk/politics. Now, at the 18th Party Congress in Beijing, the party's high command emerged from behind a scarlet curtain. And from the order that they walked in, it was possible to discern the identity of China's new leader. That man is Xi Jinping. Mr. Xi will replace Hu Jintao as the president next year, and he'll lead the world's most populous country at a time when China is expected to challenge and indeed overtake the US as the world's biggest economy. Tanya Branigan is The Guardian's Beijing correspondent, and I began by asking her, who exactly is Xi Jinping?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, what we do know about him is that he's the son of a sort of venerated revolutionary figure. So he's what's known as a princeling with a very sort of revolutionary family behind him, which means he's got good connections. We know he's worked his way up through a variety of roles that have also given him strong ties in the military and across the party in other ways. Until recently, actually, his wife was arguably better known than he was. She's a very well-known military singer. And of course, 5 years ago, he was really anointed as the heir apparent. So we've known for 5 years that he'd almost certainly become the country's leader. And yet at the same time, really, we know very, very little about him. We don't know much about what he stands for or what he believes in. This is a system that's really built on consensus and on continuity. So very deliberately, they haven't sort of shown us much of what he is or of the person. And so to a great degree, he's still a mystery. And who knows, maybe he'll be something of a mystery even when he leaves office in 10 years' time.
Do you understand, having spent time there, how it works? Or do you think it was all done in advance? And if so, how was it done?
Well, what we know is that in theory, there's a rather elaborate procedure by which there's a sort of a series of bottom-up decisions, and that ensures that the new leadership of the country expresses the will and the desires of the masses. Of course, what we actually know is that in reality, it's really all done behind the scenes. This is about decisions that are made by the incumbents and also by retired leaders, the party elders, who have a lot of input. And in the case of the new sort of top body around Xi, because of course she is only the first among equals, we know that, for example, Jiang Zemin, who was the leader before Hu Jintao, the one that's just left, we know that Jiang Zemin had a sort of pretty key role in putting that new body together. So in reality, it's very much a top-down process.
And looking ahead then, we don't know where Xi's going to come out on these things, but we do know, or we keep reading in the Western press, that China's now got a fast-growing band of, some people say, 300 million middle-class people who are making new demands. I wondered if you could just sum up for us what you think those demands are. Do you think they're more in terms of ensuring that growth and the economy continues to thrive as it has been doing, or do you think there is now a real feeling that people want more of a say, an effective say in how China is run, rather than just the right to vote in some committee that may or may not make a difference?
I think what's striking is that there is such a range of demands now that the new leadership faces. I mean, you talk about the middle class, and that's often the focus, but at the same time, I think the leadership are very much aware of this huge band of people at the bottom of society. That's certainly something that the last leadership paid a lot of attention to, people who perhaps feel left behind, who are worried about growing inequality, sense that they're not achieving the sort of the things that they should, which interestingly was one of the things that Xi Jinping talked about in his remarks to the press this morning. Needless to say, there were no questions. But what was striking, I think, firstly, that it was quite a sort of a relaxed performance. But secondly, he then made this point of talking about how people are really sort of yearning for good education for their kids and healthcare and a good environment and a decent standard of living. One analyst suggested it might be better to sort of understand it as administrative reforms, which is that if we see anything, it will probably be about a little bit more sort of accountability of cadres, perhaps a little bit more transparency, and perhaps not even that. I mean, it may simply come down to sort of more of the same, you know, yet more crackdowns, which have always been pledged and yet which don't really seem to do much to stem the rising tide of corruption, which has alienated a lot of people here.
And finally, how do you think the outgoing Hu Jintao will be remembered? Or do you think it depends on what Xi now does?
I think it's very hard to say. One of the striking things, going back and looking at the articles from 2002 when Hu Jintao took power, is that people sort of said, well, you know, here's this terribly grey figure, we don't know much about him, but now's our chance to discover the real Hu. And it's quite striking that a decade later, I'm not sure anybody feels they've really done that. We know almost as little about him and what drives him as when he came into power. There's been a lot of criticism over the last year or so of Hu Jintao and of the Premier Wen Jiabao, a sense that there's been really a period of stagnation in many regards, that they've overseen economic growth, they've kept it sort of ticking along, but they haven't really managed to move to a more sustainable model as they've said they would. particularly that there haven't been a lot of the substantive sort of social or political reforms that perhaps people hoped for. Now, there's some truth in that, although obviously I think it's also the case that people who've wanted to see reforms have really been trying to kind of rally people behind the cause. So perhaps they've made more of that. But, I mean, on the sort of the credit side, people have been sort of very hasty to write him off and say that there's not much of a legacy. But I think on the credit side, keeping the economy ticking along, given the state of the global economy, is perhaps something he should be given a bit more credit for. It's not quite as easy as it might sound, and that's something that the Who and One administration have left behind, albeit that the economy now has a lot of problems that have built up within it. And I think the other really interesting thing is that they have created a sort of skeleton of a welfare state, really, in China. It's very minimal. It's going to be a big problem paying for it, and particularly rolling it out. But that may turn out to be what they're remembered for. And as you say, it will partly depend on whether the people who've succeeded them manage to really build on that and find a way to keep funding it.
Tanya Branigan there in Beijing. You can follow all of her reports at guardian.co.uk/China. Well, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to Alan Travis, Martin Kettle, Anne Perkins and Tanya Branigan in Beijing. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.